Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Today marks the 60th day of Florida's legislative session. That means technically it's the last day of the regular session, but lawmakers aren't going home quite yet.
This is the most important thing that we do in this chamber. As you all know, as elected representatives, our only constitutional duty is to pass a balanced budget.
And also this week, both chambers have now passed a bill that implements November's Amendment 4. That's the change that restores voting rights for most felons, but some say the bill doesn't reflect the voters' intent.
The legislature has just created the same roadblocks that were in place when returning citizens had to go through the clemency process to get their rights restored.
We'll also hear about a bill aimed at improving treatment for people recovering from addiction, and we'll be talking with a veteran reporter about what he found surprising this legislative session. I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. The Florida legislature is expected to approve the final product of its budget for this year Saturday, but as Ryan Daly reports, both chambers got their turn to weigh in on the spending plan one more time today.
Our budget is growing, and it's done in an organic way. It's done because we have more people moving to the state every single day.
That's Representative Dane Eagle, vice chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Part of that growing budget that the Cape Coral Republican likes is what he says is never before seen levels of environmental funding.
In the appropriations that we've done for Everglades restoration and water quality, nearly $700 million going towards our environment, which is unprecedented.
Eagle attributes much of that effort to the commitment Governor Ron DeSantis has made to environmental spending and calls this year's budget the most Everglades-friendly in state history. Pinellas County Democrat Ben Diamond says there's one compromise in the budget he finds encouraging.
Looking at the budget from the perspective of our state's economy, I'm very pleased with the compromise we reached in keeping Visit Florida.
The state's tourism wing will be funded only for another year in the budget. Diamond says that's one area where he and House Speaker Jose Oliva don't see eye to eye.
I have great respect for my speaker, and I know we just have a principled disagreement on that issue, but I think that we landed in a good place to keep supporting the agency that is supporting and trying to help market this state.
Representative Lorraine Osley says the original plan to defund Visit Florida was a reason she had been a no vote on the House budget thus far. And because the spending plan doesn't include an across-the-board raise for state workers and what she feels is adequate funding for Hurricane Michael recovery, Osley won't be changing her mind.
But members, we have an obligation in this state to help our people recover and rebuild. And the people of the Panhandle can't wait any longer. So as much as I want to vote for this budget today, I simply can't support a budget that doesn't support our public employees or provide enough help for the people of the Panhandle.
You can't talk about a health care budget without addressing the largest threat to our health care that's occurring right now, which is the opioid crisis.
Republican Representative Ray Rodriguez says he will be voting up on the budget. He chairs the chamber's Health and Human Services Committee.
And this budget provides more than $80 million in opioid and substance abuse services.
In the Senate, too, budget silo chairs gave some of their highlights of the spending plan before a final vote is cast over the weekend. Senator Rob Bradley is the chamber's appropriations chair. He said there are four overall themes to the budget.
One would be the commitment we showed to education. There is contained herein a $250 per student increase in the FEFP.
The Senate had originally proposed a larger increase to the main funding model for public schools, but moved towards the House's position in the last few weeks. Bradley says environmental spending is another of the four budget pillars. He adds infrastructure spending is another, citing the full funding of the Florida Department of Transportation work plan. And the fourth, earmarking aid for the ailing Florida Panhandle to recover from historic Hurricane Michael, now designated as a Category 5 storm.
We are continued to be frustrated with the response of the federal government. It's been in fits and starts. But rather than wait for the D.C. to do its job, we stepped up like we always do. And thank goodness we are good fiscal stewards. We had the reserves to be able to step up.
The Senate's pre-K-12 education budget conference chair, Kelly Stargell, was asked by Democratic Senator Janet Cruz to explain a reduction in funding for the state's Schools of Hope program. The program allows charter operators to take over traditional public schools deemed persistently low-performing.
I have a note of $40 million for Schools of Hope. Where was that amount last year?
Senator Stargell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Schools of Hope number last year was quite a bit higher. This was a significant reduction, but still allowed schools that have applied and been accepted as Schools of Hope to continue moving on in the directions of which coming to the state.
Senator Cruz, for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. President. When you say significant reduction, do you have any idea what that number is?
Senator Stargell, you're recognized.
Thank you. The appropriations chair from last year is telling me it was $140 million down to $40 million.
Stargell told Cruz she feels that reduction in funding isn't an indication that the program isn't working. And Senator Aaron Bean says on health care, this year's budget goes bigger than the last.
What is the result of the work that we put in? How about a proposal that appropriates $37.6 billion, which includes 10.2 in general revenue. It's an increase of over $300 million, a 3% increase over last year's funding.
The legislature is expected to approve the budget Saturday afternoon. I'm Ryan Daly.
On the 60th day of Florida's session, the legislature has passed a bill that details how a felon would go about getting their voting rights restored. The move comes after 5.1 million Floridians voted to give felons who've completed their sentence and did not commit a felony, sexual assault, or murder their voting rights back. Since its approval in November, implementing the amendment has been a hot-button topic. Many Republicans believe terms like completion of sentence, murder, and sexual felony offense all need to be defined. WFSU's Blaise Ganey speaks with American Civil Liberties Union Kirk Bailey about his organization's view on the bill.
I'm Blaise Ganey here with Kirk Bailey, the American Civil Liberty Union's political director here in Florida, and we're going to get right into Senate Bill 7066. It was amended Thursday night to add in implementing language for Amendment 4. Can you tell me the ACLU's thoughts on this amendment?
Thank you, Blaise. I think the trouble with this legislation is, our view is that the legislature has just created the same roadblocks that were in place when returning citizens had to go through the clemency process to get their rights restored. So the bill essentially creates more delays and assures denials to the right to vote for people who we think are eligible under Amendment 4. The bill is too broad in the offenses it defines are as being excluded for, you know, individuals who still aren't eligible to vote. And it requires too much in terms of their payment of civil monetary obligations before their terms of sentence are deemed complete. And all that we don't think is consistent with Amendment 4.
All right. Now, another part of the bill talks about the financial obligations and what they must do, felons, that is, to complete them. They can either pay them in full, they can have a victim or the court forgive them for the restitution, or if a judge allows, a felon can then serve community service in lieu of payment. Now, do you all see this as a jurisdictional nightmare where felons could go to Orange County and have to do less community service maybe than a judge in Okaloosa County who may feel differently about a sentence?
Yeah, we definitely do have concerns that this legislation will be confusing and implemented in different ways in different jurisdictions, and that it'll have a disparate impact on individuals, both in its overall scope, but it'll have an unequal impact in how it's implemented around the state. Frankly, it seems to us to be administratively impossible to implement the way legislators described it, and that's why I think, you know, our view is it's assured to mean denials of the right to vote for people who are otherwise eligible.
And great. And I know instead of paying off, they can have that transferred into community service hours. And a question was asked on the floor earlier, on the House floor, about whether or not there would be an equation that would be mapped out to say X amount of hours equals X amount of dollars. The rebuttal to that from Representative Grant was that each county has their own equation that they go off of. Now, from my understanding, that there by itself automatically makes it unconstitutional, where we're going different county by county to have different ways that a person will be able to get their rights back. Is that the same way that the ACLU sees it?
Yeah, you know, I'll admit we're still evaluating all of the different the problems with this bill, but you've certainly identified one that's going to be problematic if it leads to different treatment of different individuals in different counties who are otherwise similarly situated. The amendment was designed to create a standard statewide, and because of the operation of legislation that the legislature has put in place, that doesn't turn out to be the case, it's going to present serious constitutional problems.
If it does present constitutional problems, from where I sit, I'm used to seeing, you know, people challenge this. Is that what ACLU, or have you heard of anybody expecting to do that now that it just passed in less than an hour ago? But I'd imagine those talks would have already started.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. I mean, we usually don't comment on litigation before we actually file it, which is, you know, many organizations do the same. We've obviously been evaluating these bills as they've gone through the process and asking ourselves what problems they present. We're continuing to do that, and I think we'll evaluate whether or not and on what grounds we might file litigation. Obviously, we wouldn't do that before the governor signs it. But that's definitely being considered. I would expect that that's going to be the case. We and many others have observed that there are numerous unconstitutional provisions in the various bills that have purported to implement Amendment 4. And, you know, now we're at that stage in the process where we have to make some of those decisions and go forward in the coming days and weeks.
And going forward, do you think that, I mean, it's hard to tell, but medical marijuana was also a constitutional amendment, and that took about 3 to 4 years to get fully implemented the way that the voters' intent was. And many would say that it still isn't really up to what the voters' intent was today. Do you see this as another problem that may take years to get right, seeing as the legislature only meets for 3 months out of every year?
I do think it's possible that this is going to take us some time to sort out. The one thing I will say about Amendment 4, however, is that it was clear and unambiguous. That was a position that the Florida Supreme Court took in terms of describing the language of Amendment 4. It's certainly our view that it is much clearer on its face in its language than other constitutional amendments have been. I'm not speaking specifically to medical marijuana, but it's a very small amendment. 4 was a very small amendment. It's just a little bit of language that sets out the standard for when folks should have their eligibility to vote restored. And so in that sense, I think the debate will be more focused, but it's going to take the time it takes if it ends up in litigation or if we have to come back to the legislature next year to try to remove some of these provisions that are undermining the amendment. It's definitely going to take some time.
All right. Thank you so much, Kirk Bailey with ACLU.
Thank you very much, Blaise.
Still to come on Capitol Report, why couldn't the Republican-controlled legislature finish the budget and the session today as scheduled?
If you're not making your final decisions until Tuesday late, it's going to be really hard to get out on time.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.
The only thing left for lawmakers to do tomorrow is vote on the proposed state budget. Gina Jordan spoke with Gary Finout, a writer for Politico and longtime member of the Capitol Press Corps, about why the budget was turned in late and what happens next to all the bills that passed.
Gary, how many sessions is this for you?
Well, I think it's been 23, at least 23 straight sessions in terms of how long I've been doing this. I had moments of parachuting in early in my career.
Yeah. So if you had to guess, would you say that more times than not, they get out on time or they have to extend?
I would say generally they get out on time, especially in election years. But it got a little bit bumpy during the Scott era. And then we have what happened this year.
Well, let's talk about that. So the legislature has extended one day because they have to wait a full 72 hours before voting on the proposed state budget. So what can we expect tomorrow? Are they going to just take up the budget, or might they use that time to pass more bills?
No, they do not plan to pass any more bills. We don't need to get too far into the procedural weeds, but under the terms of the Constitution, basically all legislation dies at the end of the 60th day. If you want to extend the session beyond the 60th day, you have to articulate clearly what you were going to take up during that extension. And the Senate president has made it abundantly clear that all they plan to do on Saturday is the budget and nothing else. And so every other piece of legislation, if it's not dealt with by midnight tonight, it's toast.
So why can't the chambers finish the budget on time? They're both led by the same party. The governor is the same party. Why?
The 72-hour cooling off period sort of came about as a thought that a lot of times people wouldn't know what was in the budget, and because it would get thrown together at the last minute. And it wasn't just a matter of people trying to do sneaky stuff. It was also just like sometimes there were mistakes made. So the idea was that with the 72-hour cooling off period, if there was a mistake, you could fix it in a different bill and still not have to come back. And when they start conference late, which they did this year, it just makes it really hard to get all the decisions made and everything nailed down. And they had not finalized their decisions on a lot of the stuff until Tuesday, which you just kind of knew. Okay, if you're not making your final decisions until Tuesday late, it's going to be really hard to get out on time. Now, the budget, I like to refer to as the budget, is the grease that keeps the gears of the session going. And so everything is pretty much connected. And so what we don't know is, was there sort of a delay because they were trading offers on budget items, but in reality, they were linked to some other policy bill? From a transparency point, we don't know really what's going on in the negotiations, but those always can play a factor.
So they push it to the last second, and if anything goes wrong, then oops, we have to extend a day. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, but I could not get a clear articulation if there was some policy issue that pushed them into overtime this year. There was a lot of conversations about the technology and entering stuff into the system and things of that nature, and that does take several hours to do. But as to why they were not moving quicker at the beginning, we haven't really gotten a cogent explanation.
Let's briefly touch on bills that go to the governor. They don't need his signature to go into law. Would you just talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. When the legislature passes a bill, it doesn't automatically go to the governor. I think people don't understand that nuance. Basically, so when a bill is passed while they're still in session, the governor has 7 days to act on it once he receives it. And then if it's received after session, he has 15 days. But again, the clock doesn't start until they actually physically walk the bill down to the governor. The legislature, if a bill doesn't take effect till October or January, they may not deliver the bill to the governor until, June 1st or what have you. And to your point, unlike the federal system, where there is such a thing as a pocket veto, in other words, if the president chooses not to act on a bill, it's called a pocket veto, and it dies. We have the opposite system. If the governor does not act on the bill, it still becomes law without his signature. The point is, it's going to become law anyway without your signature. So the symbolism is kind of lost.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're the governor, you own it one way or the other. So either veto the bill or sign it, I think is probably the logic that most governors have.
Yeah. So you've done this for a while. Any surprises this year for you?
Well, I mean, despite the little hiccup with the budget, they've gotten a lot done. And they have pretty much steamrolled the Democrats. And, you know, we used to have these internal fights with Republicans from the moderate and more conservative wings. I don't think we had as much as that this year. I think, obviously, the passage of the Sanctuary City ban is a clear illustration of where the legislature is and where the party is and things of that nature. So, I mean, it was just during the Scott era, there were internal fights between the House and Senate. There were fights between Scott and the legislature. And it has been, from that vantage point, we have not had as much as that this year. And I think that's the surprise, to kind of see the distinct difference from what we've been used to the last few years.
All right. Gary Fineout with Politico. Thank you very much for your time.
Good to be here.
After years discussing legislation aimed at cracking down on bad actors in Florida sober homes, lawmakers have passed a bill they hope will help ensure addicts are getting the treatment and care they need.
In the program of recovery, there's a mantra that says the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel.
St. Petersburg Democratic Senator Daryl Roussan says he wants to make sure addicts who are recovering have access to treatment and support from someone who's been there before them. But under current Florida law, Boca Raton Republican Representative Mike Caruso says it can be hard for treatment facilities to hire peer specialists. He's sponsoring a bill to help address that.
Understanding that people in addiction have often faced their own criminal issues and having screened them with a level 2 background check, this bill expands the types of low-level nonviolent crimes that qualify as exemptions for persons working solely in mental health and addiction programs for those over 18 only. These include theft, prostitution, bad checks, low-level possession charges, where the crime is committed and sentences were completed over 5 years ago.
Caruso says his son suffered from addiction and fell victim to what he calls patient brokering and the Florida shuffle,
where they shuffled him between treatment center and sober home for 6 years, treatment home, sober home, treatment, sober, treatment, and until my or his insurance ran out, and then they dumped him on the street like garbage to live a life of homelessness for the next 6 years. It almost killed him. And only by the grace of God he's doing fine today.
Caruso says sober homes are an important part of addiction treatment, but he cautions sober home workers can sometimes get kickbacks from treatment centers when they send someone from their facility back to get treatment.
Sadly, there's bad sober homes and or halfway houses that continue to plague our cities and towns. These bad actors, rehab recruiters, as they are known, lure recovering addicts like my son in a deadly cycle that addiction communities call the Florida Shuffle.
Caruso's bill works to expose bad actors within the sober home and treatment center system by expanding the definition of recovery residents to include community housing, creating more oversight for the centers. Stewart Republican Senator Gail Harrell is behind the Senate's version of the bill.
This is an endeavor of the entire community and the entire legislature. It's been 5 years in the making to get to this point, and we are finally having an impact as we address one of the major scourges that is facing this state and this country.
Harrell spoke on the chamber's floor as the Senate voted to send the measure to Governor Ron DeSantis. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally, this week, we take a trip to the beach. The perils of plastic pollution made headlines last week when a baby dolphin was found with a stomach full of plastic and had to be euthanized. As Carrie Sheridan reports, there's a new effort to track another danger that's washing ashore by the millions across the Gulf of Mexico.
Many of us have walked the beach in search of the perfect shell. Now imagine looking for something the size of a ladybug and finding it. They're called nurdles. So what exactly is a nurdle?
A nurdle is a plastic pellet. It's very small, and it's typically used to manufacture larger plastic products.
That's Maya Burke, science policy coordinator at the Tampa Bay Estuary Program. In bulk, nurdles get melted down to form all kinds of plastic products, from bottles to traffic cones to coffee makers and more. Last month, Burke found the first two nurdles in Florida on a beach near the Sunshine Skyway Bridge as part of a Gulf-wide volunteer effort to track these little plastic spheres. It's called the Nurdle Patrol, and it began with an apparent spill of nurdles on a beach in Corpus Christi, Texas in September.
I looked down and saw all these pellets in the high tide line, and I reached down and picked one up, and I knew exactly what it was. They were nurdles, and there was millions of them.
Jace Tunnell is a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin. He called the Coast Guard, who sent out the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality.
They came back and said, we don't know what to do. You know, nobody's monitoring this. We've never had to deal with it, and there's no way we can even clean all these up.
Based on what he saw, Tunnell calculated there were about a million nurdles per mile over a 30-mile stretch. So he put out a call for volunteers, beach-combing detectives, if you will, to take just 10 minutes at a local shore looking for nurdles. He says that's enough to make a difference.
So that's what started the Nurdle Patrol. We thought we need to know how long these nurdles are going to be out here and how far they've spread.
They began getting reports of nurdles as far away as Mexico City. Whether those were part of the Texas spill or not is unclear. But sometimes the pellets can be traced back to their source based on their size, shape, or color. Often birds, fish, and sea turtles mistake the pellets for food.
If they eat enough of them, they end up starving to death because there really is no nutritional value to these things. They also act like sponges, you know, absorbing toxins like DDTs and PCBs. And if they eat enough of those and there's enough toxins, it could be lethal for the animal.
As to the two nurdles Burke found in Tampa, where they came from is also a mystery. Whether they washed in from Texas or were spilled by a local manufacturer or were once the filling in a stuffed animal. She made another nurdle hunting trip recently to Ben T. Davis Beach in Tampa and found none. But she says it wasn't a waste of time.
If you're at the beach, you know, just take 10 minutes of looking, and if you don't find anything, zeros are good data too, and you can submit it to that Facebook group, the Nurdle Patrol, and then you're just documenting where they aren't.
Tunnell says he hopes the Nurdle Patrol will expand Gulf-wide and provide a better picture of the plastic that is washing up on the coastline. He's giving talks in Florida later this month, with a stop planned in Sarasota May 23rd. Other grassroots efforts have led to at least one major lawsuit against a plastic company in Texas, but Tunnell says that's not his goal.
We're not pointing the finger at industry. You know, we're just collecting the data, and it's showing high concentrations in these areas. So where's the source coming from? And really, that's the job of the environmental agencies. They're to figure that out. And I think that's exactly what they're doing.
And that's important because even as awareness is rising about the dangers of plastic in the ocean, global demand for plastics continues to grow. I'm Carrie Sheridan in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Sean Mulcahy, and Lynn Hatter. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. Please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com, and from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag.